3, Monday is 1:50. For the record, we have Representative Chenault, myself, Williams, Co-Chair Harris, Vice Chair Meyer, Representative Hocker, Schultz, and Croft. We do have a quorum. Is there anything to come before the committee before we get started with our agenda? If not, for the record, we will, I think, continue on with House Bill 16, Stranded Gas Development Act Amendments. For the record, we do have the sponsor of the bill here. We did have a lot of discussion on the amendment. It was my understanding that the amendment was okay to be, that was before us, okay to be either tabled or voted down. Representative Bates' office was in contact with Representative Whitaker. Do you have the amendment before us? Do you remember what it was? One from Whitaker. And the amendment was 23LS0101/Q.3, Senate 31003 by Representative Whitaker. And it's page 1, line 4, following group. You care to talk to the amendment, Representative Bates?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is an amendment on the floor, as I understand it, at the present time. We are prepared, should you not accept that amendment, we are prepared with an amendment that has been put before all the parties that were involved in this, the producers, the maker of the previous amendment that is on the floor. I've talked to the staff, of course, as you know, the maker of that amendment is out of state at the present time. And everybody at this point seems to be willing to accept this amendment, which you might want to call number 3, I suppose. But first, as I understand it, that the Finance Committee has to deal with the amendment that is on the floor. And after that, I would be more than happy, Mr. Chairman, to speak to this particular amendment.
It's my understanding that you have been in contact with Representative Whitaker.
I've been in contact with Representative Whitaker through his staff.
Okay, and he has no objection?
He has no objection to that, to the course of action.
Representative Croft?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Whitaker has no objection to withdrawing the amendment?
My understanding is that that's correct.
On the understanding of you, honorable gentleman, then?
Pardon?
On the understanding of you, honorable gentleman, then? Fine.
Call for the question?
I'm not calling for anything. It's whatever your discussions with Representative Whitaker have been.
There wasn't an objection. I'll call for the question.
Okay.
So we can get this thing going.
If there's any, no objections to tabling this?
I think it was.
Tabling the amendment?
Amendment.
I think we should just vote the amendment down and move on, because I think it's on the table now.
It is.
It's kind of odd, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Croft?
Because he's not here to withdraw it. Maybe Representative Harris is right that we have to deal with it, and even though you've had conversations with him, it's hard to deal with him not here, withdraw it.
We'll call for the question. Roll call.
On amendment number 2?
Yes.
Representative Chenault?
No.
Representative Croft?
Yes.
Representative Hocker?
No.
Representative Chu is not here. Representative Meyer?
Nope.
Representative Schultz? Representative Harris?
No.
And Representative Williams?
No. Motion fails?
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 3.
Object, just to hear about it.
Do you care to talk to the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Who's that?
Yeah, I'll let sponsor speak to the member, Mr. Chairman, if he wants to, or I can speak to it.
Well, I was just going to say, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Amendment number three would embody the entire thing, which is basically three things. Two numbers, one from 10 to, from 15% to 10%. That's line two, page two, line 29. Page two, line 31 is from 25% to 15%. And of course, there is intent language. So those are the basic three changes.
Any discussion on amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we're lowering the net worth requirements. This project is currently estimated to be a $10 billion one. Do we have any idea?
Through the chair, from Prudhoe Bay to Aco Hub, it's considered to be about $9 billion.
So
lowering that net worth figure will allow what the desire of many were, including myself, to allow the commissioner to qualify sponsors who would be able to get in then to the project.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In sort of round numbers, before we said a company to be considered would have to have a net worth in the range of $1.5 billion, and now it would be closer to a little under $1 billion.
That's approximately correct, yes, through the chair. It might even be slightly more than that, depending on how many qualified sponsors the commissioner qualified.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions or discussion on amendment number three?
I don't have any continued objection to it.
Any other objections to amendment number three? Not amendment number three, adopted. Are there any more? Amendment number four by Representative Croft.
I'll move amendment number four, Mr. Chairman.
Object.
Yeah, I apologize for not getting this to you sooner. It came from a lot of the discussion we had last week and me ruminating on it. We're really in a sort of odd position with the clear constitutional prohibition on assigning away or agreeing to any waiver of our right to taxation. And I guess I wanted it clear in the legislation that we weren't trying to do something that we can't do constitutionally. And if we are, then if we are trying to do this unconstitutionally, that creates its own set of problems. So just as I went over my thought process of what these things can and can't do, it seemed cleaner to me to clarify what is, after all, a constitutional truth of this matter, that we can't do that. And so it's a long amendment, but really the only thing that it adds is just repeating the language until D. Nothing in this chapter shall be construed to permit the state to suspend or contract away the power of taxation. I don't think we can do that anyway. I just wanted it clear.
For the record, Representative Foster is present. So what you're saying is that we can't do it anyway because it's in the Constitution, but we're going to put it in legislation so that it will remind us that we can't do that?
You said it clearer than I did, Mr. Chairman, yeah.
We'll be able to do this with every piece of legislation pertaining to the amendment, the Constitution. If we were to do this with every piece of legislation that pertains to the Constitution, and we put this in with, you know, we're not going to break the law, and certainly the Department of Law, the Attorney General's office, wouldn't let us do it. And I'm sure that the people that write up our pieces of legislation tell us we're not going to do it. I don't understand your belt and suspenders.
Well, it's a good point, Mr. Chairman. Rarely do we play so close to the constitutional line, though. Rarely have we got things that are trying to do something that is so close to a prohibition. Usually our acts, at least we try to, are clearly within a constitutional realm. Here we're trying to sign contracts that give some certainty, but knowing that we can't give this power away if we wanted. And I guess in this odd situation where we're butting up against constitutional limits, we ought to at least acknowledge that they're there and that we know that they're there.
Representative Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there anybody here from the Attorney General's office?
I'm authorized to speak for him.
That's what I'm concerned about. That's what I'm concerned about, Mr. Chairman.
He played as our attorney for the last 3 days on his
I was trying to help you out. We were trying to get him up here the last time while Attorney General Croft was making his motions. I've heard the debate, the discussion that you and the good representative from Anchorage had, and I don't understand why we need to have this in here, but what I don't know is if it would have any harm or not being in there. That's not being an attorney. I don't know. I'm always leery about that, you know. And so, maybe we could call up Senator Parnell if he would like to come up from there to see what their
In lieu of the Attorney General.
Not in lieu of the Attorney General.
unlike Representative Croft, I won't say that I speak for the Attorney General today. I'm Sean Parnell, representing ConocoPhillips. I have a question, Mr. Chairman. Or
the question that I had, Senator Parnell, is that subparagraph D, nothing in this chapter shall be construed. I'm sure you've seen the amendment. What effect, if any, on the bill will it have, and does it have any effect on proposed project that you may be looking at?
We, just by way of background, we got the amendment just moments before the hearing, so I haven't had a lot of time to look at it, but I can tell you that the amendment does cause our company a lot of concern, because what it does is, well, let me back up. We're looking for a clean bill. I mean, this bill should be akin to extending sunsets on legislation. I mean, that's what it really should be akin to, and yet we're starting to load it up with other amendments. And so where companies are looking for certainty in making whether it's a $9 billion investment or, you know, $20 billion total investment, this does not further certainty either. And I would also argue that there is nothing in this legislation that surrenders the power of taxation. In fact, the Stranded Gas Act is all about finding out what the company's tax obligations are up front, before they invest billions of dollars. So there is no surrender that I see of taxing authority or tax power on the state's part. It's not even close to the line as I saw it. But again, I think, you know, this is a probably better question for the AG's office, but from our standpoint, this should not be included in the bill.
Are there any questions for Senator Parnell? Thank you.
Thank you.
Any more discussion on amendments? Did you get a hold of anybody at the Department of Law? No? Did you want to talk to this, Randy, at all?
Put your poor staff on the line.
Look at all these attorneys involved in it.
Yeah.
Maybe.
My name is Randy Barraro, aide to your office. I think there's two different things. I think the amendment talks about the power to tax, and then I think what Senator Parnell was talking about was the amount of the tax. So I think it's two different things. You're not giving away the power to tax. You're just finding out the amounts ahead of time. You're still taxing. It's just you're working out the amounts ahead of time. So you're not giving it away for free with no authority to tax. You're just figuring out the amounts ahead of time. That's, I guess, how I'd see it.
Representative Croft.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to bring it up. I wasn't positive it was needed. The more discussion we have about the producer's objection to it, the more sure I am that we do need it. The goal of fiscal certainty here is very close to the idea of us agreeing that we will never change our tax policy, something the Constitution says we cannot do.
Yeah.
And you cannot, the property taxes may be adjusted after the time the Stranded Gas Act is enacted. They want, they've used phrases like a moral commitment or other such things, and we've got to be clear that we should not and cannot negotiate away the power of future legislatures to change that tax regime.
I hear what you're saying, Representative Croft, and I agree with you. You know, I also would like to give a little support to, or show support to the people that are negotiating this, and I'm sure that the people that do work for us, both in the Attorney General's office and the legislature here, certainly won't let that happen. And we stand up to protect the Constitution at all times, and I don't see any problem. I don't see any reason that we should put this in the legislation if it's already the Constitution.
I tell you what, Mr. Chairman, I did not mean to delay the proceedings here, and I thought it was important, and it was something that came along as I thought more and more about the matter. Why don't I go ahead and withdraw it? I will send a copy to the Attorney General's office. I may very well offer this when it hits the floor, but I didn't mean to delay us so much as I thought. I think it's a critical constitutional issue, but I'd be glad to fax it to them, and we don't have to wait here for that. So I'll withdraw Amendment Number 4.
Thank you, Representative Croft. Are there any more amendments? Representative
Yeah, I'll go ahead and move out HB 16 out of committee with individual recommendations as amended with the attached personnel.
Any objections? Not the bill moves from committee with individual recommendations, task fiscal note.
I'd like to thank the chair and any members of the committee. Thank you very much.
Senate Bill 51. We have a sponsor here. Please state your name for the record and who you represent, please.
Devin Mitchell, I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority and work in the Department of Revenue of the State of Alaska. The bill, Senate Bill 51 before the committee today, does two separate things. First, it increases the total borrowing cap of the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority from $300 million to $500 million. This cap of $300 million has been in place since 1984 when it was increased from $150 million. It had been increased from a previous cap of $100 million in the prior year. The second thing the bill does is increase the ability to issue revenue bonds in any fiscal year from $50 million to $75 million. The file that the committee should have has some background information, but just to give a little perspective on the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank, it's a public corporation. Created in 1975, it was funded by the legislature by appropriations of $18.6 million between 76 and 86. The bond bank is a conduit borrower in as much as it only borrows money when there is a community project at hand. And so currently there are about $240 million in bonds outstanding for projects in a variety of communities throughout the state. The current application load that the bond bank has been experiencing, I expect us to exceed the $300 million cap in fiscal year 2004, and that's why we're here before the committee. And in addition to that, we've received revenue bond applications during fiscal year 2003 that exceed the $50 million cap. And so we're looking at a community in Representative Harris's district, Valdez, being the last one to come to the bond bank authority. And so asking that community to either wait to finance their project until fiscal year 04 or requiring a more costly process of issuing two series of bonds. The bond bank, I don't know, a little bit of justification for the program. The savings that it provides to the community over the last three fiscal years have been between $3 and $4 million in savings on costs of financing capital projects. And in addition to those savings, the bond bank also provides an annual dividend to the state of Alaska. And so in fiscal year 2002, there was a $1.67 million transfer to the state of Alaska effective in FY03, and in addition to that, a $3 million in savings, $4.7 million if you total it up, which is a fairly good return on investment from the $18.6 million that was originally plugged in. If there were any questions that the committee had about either the bond bank or the need to increase the cap, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The public policy question, I guess, in increasing this statute and increasing your authority is us watching to make sure that the municipalities are not overly burdening themselves with debt. So how do we know that that's the case? How do we know that this number isn't an excessive number and they're not getting themselves into trouble and us helping them through raising this limit?
Through the Chair, Representative Croft, there's an independent board of directors of the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority, and each loan application that comes to the authority has to be approved by that board of directors. We employ a financial advisor who reviews the application of the underlying, the borrowing municipality, reviews their financial statements for 3 years. And so we make a recommendation to our board, who then can approve or deny an application. So there is a system of checks and balances. It's not an automatic source of cash for a capital project. And if the borrower can increase their likelihood of having a project approved for financing by going through additional public process at the local level, the general obligation pledge of a community is obviously the strongest pledge they can give, which requires a lot of local support. And so there's a variety of things that go into any one application's review.
Do you ever reject them?
Through the Chair, Representative Croft, we try not to reject people from at the board level. What we try to do is if the community has a project that is not well thought out or is, for example, partially funded, we suggest to them that they explore alternatives, whether it's if it's a community that doesn't have the wherewithal to repay the bonds, the loan that we would be making to them. We would suggest they explore grant opportunities. There's other loan opportunities out there, although they have constraints as well. There's the clean water and drinking water programs, the revolving funds of the state of Alaska. There's USDA programs that sometimes can fit a community's needs better than the bond bank. And so it's, a collaborative process that we would work with a community to try to allow them to move forward with the proper community support for a project they want to achieve. And if the bond bank is the right answer, then it's not.
I assume we've never defaulted. Has any individual municipality ever defaulted to us?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any other questions for the sponsor?
Mr. Chairman.
What's up, Harris?
Kevin, thank you. is this enough? I mean, Representative Cross, I asked you. Ask you if it was too much. I'm going to ask you, is it enough? Do you anticipate, my understanding, it's the first time you've come back to the legislature since the 80s asking for an increase. Is this, in this time when Alaska is obviously looking at rebuilding, a lot of communities are looking at, and cities are going out for bonds to do schools and other facilities and things like that. Is this give enough leeway for you?
I believe it does. That the bond bank is a mature program, having been around since the 70s. A lot of our debt is paying off each fiscal year. So if we, and a lot of that is due, taking a step back, due to the school debt reimbursement program, where the state requires communities to issue at least 10-year notes, and then they get reimbursement from the state of Alaska on some percentage of their bonds they issue. So a lot of our debt's 10-year debt. It's quickly paying off, so you have this steep repayment curve. While we've had a steep borrowing curve as well, it's been a very gradual process. And I think it also behooves the committee and the legislature to maintain a good understanding of the moral obligation debt of the state of Alaska, which this is moral obligation debt, meaning that if there were a default by an underlying community, there would be a request made of the legislature to replenish a reserve fund within the bond bank authority, as well as this request would be made of the legislature and the executive branch. And so I think that it's a good step to take to allow some of the increased local borrowing needs to be met while still maintaining a good control over that authority.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Foster?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and move on SB 51 with individual recommendations on the attached list.
Any objections to moving the bill to the committee with that fiscal note? If not, so moved. Thank you. Next, we'll take up House Bill, or Senate Bill 78. The sponsor here.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. This is my name for the record is Jacqueline Dupoe, and I'm here for Senate Bill 78, staff for Senator Green. And we're proud and excited to be able to bring this legislation before you. This removes the sunset provision on the 2001 legislation, so it ensures continued treatment for the women that have been participating in the breast and cervical cancer program. It also gives future certainty to those persons that will be diagnosed with breast and cervical cancer in the future. Secondly, our bill does a different thing. It also gives authority to the Department of Health and Social Services to allow maximum cost sharing as per the federal law. And by way of information, currently, the state of Alaska, we are imposing the maximum cost sharing. But we are bound, if you look in the statutes, there's a lot of places where it says the word lesser. So it says, well, here is the federal maximum and here's the state's maximum, and that we have to be doing the lesser of the two. What this legislation does is it gives that authority. It's a futuristic provision that if the federal government, if they change the maximum allowed under their program, then we could submit an amended state program in which we can raise the level of cost sharing to these participants. And you'll have in front of you there, if you have your packets, breast and cervical cancer has a specific category of the Medicaid program, and it actually allows for 250% of the poverty level. So it's the highest of all the programs. If you look there for a family of three, it's $46,950, or for a family of four, it's $56,575. So we're talking about a different sort of category here, and so it does allow for a cost sharing if the government does provide for that in the future.
Are there any questions for the sponsor?
A big question comes up right off the top. We want to look into one of the problems that we have for the state in our health and social service budget. All we need to do is look at the fiscal note that we have attached here. The way I read this fiscal note, we are anticipating in this present year, if this bill passes, about $282,000, is that correct, out of general funds?
General funds,
to match approximately $680-some thousand of federal funds. Now, if we move along to the year 2009, we a little bit better than double, or pretty close to double, what we're looking at in general funds, the $544,000, is that correct?
That is correct. That, and that's a projected number, obviously.
I understand that, but it's probably not too far off, simply because if we look at all the programs that we've had in health and social services over the years, it started off here and all of a sudden are way up here. We see the problem that we're having. I mean, that whole department has just gone crazy. How do we get control of it? Can you answer this question? Is this an optional program under the Medicaid options list?
No, but through the chair, this program, it came to pass the way it sort of evolved. It started off initially as a screening program, and they had allocated dollars for there to be screening. But then we had these, you know, women who had been diagnosed. They found out, yes, you have breast cancer. Yes, you know, it's progressed to this point, and if you don't receive treatment, then you will die. So at that point, we were letting these women know, hey, just so you know, this is what's going on. I'm sorry you can't afford health care. So then later, they enacted something just to sort of close that loop so that we had, you know, the diagnosis and treatment. So both of those things were occurring so that we weren't just diagnosing people that couldn't afford treatment at that point. So this is currently a required category through that legislation.
It's required by the federal government?
By the federal government, yeah.
Are you sure?
Through the chair, it's right here. If you look, let's see. There's, in the 106th Congress, the Public Law 106-354 is where it was enacted.
Can you read that to me?
Yeah, I can. Through the chair, yes. It says, covers an optional category for new people in general, and then it goes through.
Can you say that again?
the coverage of optionally categorically needy people. So but it's predicated upon your participation in the diagnosis program. And so because we have the diagnosis program through the chair, then we have to do the treatment. So it sort of closes that loop. So because our state has chosen to participate in the diagnosis part of the program, then this is sort of an if-then statement. Then now we have to participate in the treatment part of the program. So to sort of what you're pointing out, if we weren't participating in the initial diagnosis program, then we would have an option, from my understanding, to get out of the treatment part of the program.
Okay, so explain to me then, is the diagnosis part of it an optional program?
But currently the diagnosis isn't through the chair. It's not an optional program. So it's sort of like a catch-22. There's this program that you have to be a part of, and then because you're a part of this program that you have to be a part of, then there's the optional treatment group to close that loop. So it's sort of tricky. So it is an optional program, but not really, because you have to participate in diagnosis, and if you're participating in that, then you have to offer treatment.
Well, it's kind of like you're partially pregnant. You can't be partially pregnant, so you're either. So you're telling me, and I'm not being combative here, believe me, I'm trying to get to the bottom of this. If the federal government says we have to be involved in the diagnosis
Correct.
Program, we have to be?
Correct. The federal
they program. Mandate it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Can we bring up Elmer Lindstrom at the same time? I think he lives and breathes this stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I know Elmer can say it differently. And still get his point across. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Elmer Lindstrom, Special Assistant to Commissioner Gilbertson with the Department of Health and Social Services.
Would you get, you're listening to my questioning there. Does the federal government mandate a screening program?
Mr. Chairman, we take advantage of the federal dollars for the screening program, but it is not a mandate.
So it's optional?
That's correct.
And so this program is optional as well, is that right? Breast and cervical cancer, Medicaid eligibility?
Mr. Chairman, the Medicaid program also is optional.
Okay, that's what I thought. I was trying to get to that, but so you've answered that part of my question there. It's not mandatory that we do this, obviously, but we've chosen to, and probably for good reason. Elmer, do you see this? My name is Mr. Chairman. Continue my line of questioning here. I'm back to my old health and social service hat here for a minute.
Please, I'm happy to share it with you.
You see the fiscal note, and we've all seen what's happened to the health and social service budget over the years with the general fund match to take advantage of all these federal monies coming in. Do you believe that we're going to have the clients or the women that are going to have being able to take advantage of this program continue to increase to make that budget amount for fiscal year 09 up to $544,000 a realistic thing? Or is it going to be the cost of actually delivering the service, kind of a combination of the two? Or what's driving this major increase in cost projected out over the years?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I think the fiscal note that you have before you, if you were to go back and look at the fiscal note that was prepared on the initial authorizing legislation several years ago, these numbers are well within those original projections. So I have some confidence that the initial program, the initial fiscal note was pretty accurate, because this is not inconsistent with what we initially projected. If you look at page 2 of 2 on the fiscal note, there are two drivers to the increased cost. Item number 1 at the top of the page is an assumption of a 5% annual increase in total recipients. And item number 2 directly below that is an assumption that expenditures in this category will grow at a rate of 10% per year. And that is similar to the national average growth for Medicaid spending. So the short answer, Mr. Chairman, believe that this fiscal note is probably pretty accurate. And it is a combination of an increase in the number of eligibles and about double that percentage increase in the costs of the services that are provided on an annual basis.
What other programs can we add on to that optional list to drive up the cost of health care in the state for Medicaid?
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I would commend to you...
I'm being facetious. Don't get me...
I would commend to you legislation that was introduced last week at the request of the governor, and I hope you will see a package of Medicaid bills in this committee very shortly. Then I think actually would put some tools in the toolbox of the department relative to cost containment over time.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, just for the record, the department, the administration enthusiastically support this legislation, and the governor would look forward to having it on his desk at the earliest possible date. If you have any real technical Medicaid questions, I have staff here from the Division of Medical Assistance, and I believe online is Ann Gore, who is with the screening program operated through the Division of Public Health, if the committee would have any questions about that program.
Okay. Are there any further questions for the sponsor? If not, we do have an amendment. I'd like for you guys to stay where we are. Representative Croft?
Ready for amendments at this time, Mr. Chairman?
Pardon?
You're ready for amendment, the amendment at this time? If that's what you'd like, I'll move amendment number one. It's 23LS0592/A1 Lauterbach. And it doesn't have my name on it. It should, so Representative Croft. Starts page one, lines 2 through 3, delete relating to the cost sharing.
Any objection?
I will against it. No, I'm really against it.
No objection, I guess.
Yes, object. Yeah.
You object, Mr. Chairman?
Amendment one, yes.
Too late.
Never too late. Well, sorry. Can I get a, the reason I objected, Mr. Chairman, is I can get an explanation for Representative Croft about his amendment.
Thank you, I guess. The amendment deletes some of the cost-sharing language, which I've been struggling over the exact definition. There are cost-sharing that you can do Medicaid-wide. It is disturbing to me to have one particular special cost-sharing language. I think as part of the package that we're going to consider coming up, it may be appropriate to talk about system-wide Medicaid cost-sharing, but I do not believe it's either appropriate or maybe even allowed to do this in just the slice that we're looking at here. Sort of three levels, legally, practically, but more important to me is the mixed message it sends. If this committee or the subcommittee or Hess itself or the governor want to consider Medicaid-wide cost-sharing techniques, that's appropriate and I'd love to participate in it. I do not want it as part of this bill for just this slice of the population. And we talked in the prior bills we had in this committee here about putting a clean bill forward. I think we'd be better served making this a clean bill, and I think that's what amendment number one does.
Sponsor, care to comment?
Yeah, through the chair, there has been a lot of talk about this specific category of Medicaid, the breast and cervical cancer. But again, like I stated, this specific category has 250% of poverty level, and additionally, this has no asset tax. So hypothetically, there could be a family of four. They make $56,575 a year. They've got two boats, two cars, a Land Rover in the driveway, a cabin at the lake. This has no asset test. And so the persons that we're talking about in this category, they're not at the 100% level of poverty level. They're not at the 200%. This is a specific category where they are at the 250% of poverty level, which already makes this a special category.
Representative Croft, you can...
Sure.
I'll let this go just one more time.
One more
and
round.
We'll move on a little bit.
I didn't ask. You recognized me. Okay. It's like you wanted me to. Okay.
If you care to wait, we'll come back to you.
Sure. Okay. Whatever you say.
Stoltz.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sponsor, perhaps the department. Since this is the Finance Committee, I just wonder what the fiscal impact is.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the fiscal note would be accurate in either case. And this amendment would not impact the fiscal note either in terms of expenditures or in revenues.
Ask on that point.
It does not impact the fiscal note?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair. At this point, it won't, but that's why this is a futuristic bill, because it's a providing if in the future the federal government allows for more cost sharing for women in these categories, then we could take advantage of that. So it's giving us the authority to do something that currently it won't have a fiscal impact. But if the federal legislation changes, then in turn this gives a tool to the department that they have that authority at that point to impose more cost sharing, which might, I mean, in some minimal way, impact the fiscal note.
So a person, a woman that has cancer, may get worried. She's already got something on her mind right now. And then let's say the federal government changes that and then she's got more on her mind because her family is going to have to pay for it. Is that where it comes down to?
Through the chair, if you look at the copays right now, on prescription drugs, it's $2. On physician's visits, $3. Inpatient stays, there's a maximum of $200. We're talking about minimal amounts. But, you know, that's why we've given this there, for those people that do have an opportunity to pay, and I think would be willing to pay. Sometimes, you know, maybe you can't pay for all of your cancer treatment, but you can feel good that you're contributing part of it. And the needs of those persons and their expenses are definitely taken into account. And the federal government right now is very, very minimal in what they are allowing. That's why right now we're at $2 and $3. So even if this is raised, it's not going to be that substantial. But we do anticipate that those women will be able to pay a little bit of their own way.
Representative Croft.
Elmer. Isn't it true that the reason this doesn't affect the fiscal note, taking out a cost-sharing measure, is we can't do this now anyway?
Mr. Chairman, the language you have in Senate Bill 78 is very similar to language that was in the legislation authorizing the Denali Kid Care Program. And what was true relative to that program at that time is true relative to this program at this time. That is, would not, under current federal law, be able to implement any additional cost-sharing provisions, barring a change in federal law. That was true when the Denali Kid Care legislation passed, although in that case, we actually did petition the federal government for authority to do additional cost-sharing. The response came back from the federal government, no, you cannot, barring a change in federal law. So the benefit of this language in the department's mind is it's basically educational. As the sponsor's staff indicated, this is one of the programs where the income eligibility is significantly greater than is typically the case for a Medicaid program. Denali Kid Care was another. So to the extent the legislature would choose to reiterate the notion that particularly for these programs where income eligibility is relatively high, that should we have the permission to do so from the feds, it would be the policy to increase those co-payments, cost-sharing arrangements that may well have some educational benefit in making that statement. But it would not materially change the fiscal note or the way we operate the bill with or without the language.
Do we see anything down the road with the federal government putting this type of language in their bill?
Mr. Chairman, I am not aware of anything that is pending before Congress at this time on this subject. On the other hand, the federal law is churning constantly relative to Medicaid, and there are always proposals being brought forward, but I'm not aware of anything at this time, Mr. Chairman.
This is just a feel-good situation and education, did you say?
To the chair, it does give authority to the department, though. I mean, it doesn't do nothing. It's not, you know, just feel good. I mean, right now, currently, it won't have a fiscal impact, but it does give authority, and it is futuristic with its language, but it is giving authority to the department to up those amounts that the federal regulations allow, so.
Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't hear from Mr. Lindstrom or the department. Do they have a definitive position on this? I know it's not an old issue, so they probably have talked about it. Just out of curiosity, if the administration has a position, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's been a worthwhile debate and discussion on this language, and we would defer to the judgment of the legislature on this matter.
given the boldness and courageousness, I guess, of seeing the last week, I guess I'm a little disappointed.
Any other discussion on the amendment?
I'll just sum up.
Representative, any more discussion or care to wrap up there?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, it's my understanding that the reason that the Denali Kid Care requested waiver was rejected was because it was going towards a particular slice of people. That if we may be able to talk about Medicaid-wide cost sharing, but that we're not going to be successful, as we were not in Denali Kid Care, not going to be successful here, asking we want to have cost sharing only for this particular group of people. And so for the very reason we were rejected in the Denali Kid Care case, I believe we'll be here. Coming back to the point you mentioned on the women that we're talking about and the stress that's already in their lives, we're essentially giving the department permission to charge them an uncertain amount if an uncertain thing happens in the future. And we certainly have time to revisit either cost sharing in general or this cost sharing when and if the feds ever do something like that. Somebody described it as a feel-good provision. To me, it's a feel-bad provision. I don't like what it says about our commitment here and would prefer that we send a cleaner, better message to these women.
Any other discussion on the motion? Not call for the roll call.
Amendment one.
Yes.
Representative Hawker?
No.
Representative Meyer?
No.
Representative Stoltz?
No.
Representative Chenault?
No.
Representative Croft?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Williams?
Yes.
Representative Harris?
No.
Five no, three yes.
Motion is defeated. What's the wishes of the committee? Representative Foster?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and move out SB 78 out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached system.
Is there any objections? If not, we'll move from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
4 tomorrow.
We came up with in the Senate like this, didn't we?
I thought we were having a meeting tomorrow.
You got any green?
Yeah.
Yes. And this says March 12th. Okay. We are having a meeting tomorrow. And we have 3 bills up. We have, I don't know what the numbers are.
But you will in a second.
House Bill 67, which is construction of highways by DOT. House Bill 91, retired peace officers, cost of living, medical benefits. And Senate Bill 20, Board of Marine Pilots. We'll probably hear the Senate bill first tomorrow. But, and then we'll start at 1:30. Is there anything more to come before the committee before we adjourn? If not, we're adjourned. Please stand by to sign your...